In the 1960s, my generation set out on a journey of change. Coming out of an atmosphere of conformity, a new spirit began to appear. One of the first signs was a demonstration organized by Berkeley students in May of 1960 against the House Un-American Activities Committee.
What we are here to do is to gather information, as we are ordered to do by an act of Congress, with respect to the general operation of the communist conspiracy.
I'm not in the habit of ever being intimidated, and I don't expect to start now. Now, what was your question?
Please, Mr. Chairman.
What was your question?
Are you now, this instant, a member of the Communist Party?
We came out to protest because we were against HUAC's suppression of political freedom. In the 50s, HUAC created a climate of fear by putting people on trial for their political beliefs. Any views left of center were labeled subversive. We refused to go back to McCarthyism.
If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
As witness after witness denounced the committee, the hearings grew stormy. The halls outside were filled with students seeking admission. Suddenly, the police turned fire hoses full force on the demonstrators inside the rotunda and then dragged them down the steps of City Hall. It turned out to be a political baptism that transformed fear into determination. Something had changed. After this, it would never be the same.
Now, the whole thing might have died down except for the fact that the committee made a film. The film was called Operation Abolition. And the film presented all of us, I had been in these demonstrations myself, and it presented all of us as somehow or other engaged in a vast communist plot, not only to try to overthrow the United States government, but even worse, to try to abolish the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Operation Abolition. Operation Abolition. This is what the communists call their current drive to destroy the House Committee on Un-American Activities and to render sterile the security laws of our government. You will see revealed the long-time classic communist tactic in which a relatively few well-trained, hardcore communist agents are able to incite non-communists to perform the dirty work of the Communist Party.
That movie was scheduled to be shown at the Harvard ROTC class, the ROTC class. They had a class on campus, and they were going to show Operation Abolition. And I'd heard all about Operation Abolition, and I was clearly opposed to it and all that. So a bunch of us decided to go to the class to protest. And I remember very, very well that the way we protest, in the film, there's a place where the students stand up singing the Star Spangled Banner to show HUAC that, hey, don't pull you're more American than us on us. And the group of us stood up in the ROTC class to show that we were in solidarity with the students in San Francisco. But what I really remember clearly is thinking, hey, wait a minute, what am I doing here? Why aren't I there? And I checked this story out with a whole lot of people who were at Berkeley, and they told me the exact same story, that Operation Abolition had recruited them to Berkeley, that they had seen it around the country in and gone in to see it as a protest, and they'd thought, wow, let's go there.
Everybody thinks my head's full of nothing, wants to put his special stuff in, fill a space with candy wrappers, keep out sex and revolution, but there's no hole in my head. Too bad.
The university is being called upon to educate previously unimagined numbers of students. to respond to the expanding claims of national service, to merge its activities with industry as never before. Characteristic of this transformation is the growth of the knowledge industry, which is coming to permeate government and business, and to draw into it more and more people raised to higher and higher levels of skill. The production, distribution, and consumption of knowledge is said to account for 29% of gross national product, and knowledge production is growing at about twice the rate of the rest of the economy. What the railroads did for the second half of the last century and the automobile for the first half of this century may be done for the second half of this century by the knowledge industry, and that is to serve as the focal point for national growth.
When we went to college, President Kerr's vision became our reality. The University of California was a knowledge factory, the biggest public university in America. It did research for major corporations, and it ran the government's nuclear weapons labs. Of the seven campuses, Berkeley was the jewel in the crown, with the most prestigious faculty. Within the sea of students, there was little evidence of political life, but a few of us who were interested in politics found each other and started an organization called Slate. Some radical students had gotten together and to run a slate of candidates in the student elections. And although Slate was not really solely about student elections, the student elections were used as a kind of platform through which we could educate other students and reach them about the various issues that were alive during that time.
Friends wrote me letters of the discussions that were happening in the coffee shops of Berkeley. You know, people were interested in politics there. Something was happening. They had already organized some little dinky, you know, student activist group on campus that was starting to experiment with actually doing things.
I grew up in a small ethnic community in Buffalo, New York. I just knew I couldn't live within its limitations. I had a couple years of college there. I quit school. I hitchhiked around. I ended up in San Francisco. I got married. And then I went back to school, and I came to Berkeley really. I was looking for truth. I was looking for meaning in my life.
One of the most distressing tasks of a university president is to pretend that the protest and outrage of each new generation of undergraduates is really fresh and meaningful. In fact, it is one of the most predictable controversies that we know. The participants go through a ritual of hackneyed complaints, almost as ancient as academe, while believing that what is said is radical and new.
From the very beginning, the administration at Cal was trying to undermine and really prevent what we were trying to do. They were very upset about the introduction of what they called off-campus issues. Anything having to do with civil rights or with the testing of nuclear weapons or apartheid in South Africa, these were off-campus issues. Well, this, of course, is what we were attacking. We were opposed to sandbox politics. The administration really started turning the screws. They disenfranchised the graduate students because that was a big block of the Slate vote. And then they actually threw the organization off campus. There was a big outrage at that. We got reinstated. So there was a growing community of people who wanted to make liberal or left or radical, however they thought about it, politics legitimate in the country.
When we look at modern man, we have to face the fact that modern man suffers from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to his scientific and technological abundance. We've learned to fly the air like birds. We've learned to swim the seas like fish. And yet we haven't learned to walk the earth as brothers and sisters.
I woke up this morning when the man said I'm freedom. Oh, and I woke up this morning when the man.
More than any other cause, the civil rights movement became the wellspring of student activism and inspired our entire generation. In 1963, Berkeley students began to band together with black activists to protest discriminatory hiring practices of Bay Area businesses. We sat in at restaurants, supermarkets, and automobile showrooms. Our biggest challenge came when we tried to secure jobs for blacks and other minorities in the hotels of San Francisco. A picket line formed around the Sheraton Palace while negotiations with the Hotel Owners Association took place inside.
It was getting to the point where we were saying we are going to create a confrontation. We're going to create a situation that's intolerable, and we're going to force you to respond to it in some way, and we're willing to get arrested in order to do it, and now the ball's in your court.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
All of us in this elegant lobby, I can't convey to you the effect. It's like the riffraff coming to the White House or something, and the real Democratic masses had moved in and taken over, you know, saying, no, you cannot continue to run this hotel in this racist fashion. The world is being redefined. Things cannot continue on that way. They just won't.
We just entered into discussions with the Sheraton Palace for the last 8 hours, and we were given a 7-page document which was supposed to summarize the agreement, but it seemed that there was only one hitch. The Sheraton Palace wasn't willing to sign.
It was the first major victory of anything I had been involved in. The Sheraton Palace Hotel arrests and convictions and trials and so forth led to the first agreement that I knew of in the North of its kind. And that was an agreement between the entire hotel industry and the Ad Hoc Committee to End Discrimination to hire minority individuals in all levels of employment, including management. Was very historic, and it was very elevating, and it really pumped us all up to think that, my God, we really could have an effect on history. We could have an effect on lives of people we'd never know, we'd never meet. And it was simply by taking seriously the words of the Constitution and the preamble and the Declaration of Independence and all that stuff that we believed in, you know, with great vim and vigor. And here we just saw it happen, and it worked.
It was a very thrilling experience for us, but the flip side of it is other people saw it in very different light. That is, the business community saw it as a threat, as something that's going to cause them some real problems. And the fact that 100 Berkeley students were arrested, probably 500, 600, 800 Berkeley students were involved in the thing. It just portend things to come, and very quickly there was pressure put down on the university. You've got to stop this, and the terms that were being used is the university cannot be used as a base for attacks on the community.
In the fall of the school year 64-65, we return to campus and find out that the tables on Bancroft and Telegraph, which had historically been the campus political activity lifeline, were banned.
Tables have been permitted out in front of Bancroft and Telegraph to distribute literature. And these literatures, including the ideas of policy and advocating stands. At this particular point, we have been denied this, and we think, whether or not this is true or not, as far as why they're doing it, the effect of cutting this off is to stop political activity on this campus.
We knew at the time that it was aimed at the civil rights movement and at progressive organizations and at those of us interested in the peace movement and civil rights, mainly civil rights. But by banning all of us, they created an enormous reaction because they united a group of people around the need to have those tables that couldn't have united themselves under any other circumstances.
We told them they had to go back on the streets where they'd been traditionally for this kind of activity. And they then took the position that we want to undertake these activities on campus property itself, and we said this is not possible.
When the university banned political action at Bancroft and Telegraph, they said it was the same as the rest of the campus and therefore it was illegal. We said if it's the same as the rest of the campus, then we can do this anywhere because if we were right there, we have a right anywhere. We decided to move our tables to Sather Gate.
There were five students sitting at tables, and deans came by and said, if you don't leave, we're going to have to cite you. And the students, I remember one of them said, I'm sorry, sir, my organization has not authorized me to leave this table. And so he was cited. As soon as the student was cited, the dean would go to the next table to cite the next student. Somebody would get up, somebody else sit in their place. So after they cited the five people, they just didn't want to be there writing all day. So the dean started leaving. People said, oh, me too, me too. Well, at 3 o'clock, 500 people marched into Sproul Hall and saying, whatever you do to those people, you've got to do to us.
If you don't stand up for your freedom now, you're dead, guys.
And the deans wanted the students who were cited to go into the dean's office. We said, well, we all did it. You have to treat us all the same. So we were out in the halls, and nobody would go into the office. And at about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, they announced that those five people plus three of the demonstration leaders were suspended. Well, the next morning, we really knew it was going to happen. We set our tables up right in front of Sproul Hall steps. I guess I was one of the more noisy people, so a dean came up to me and he asked me to identify myself, and I refused to identify myself. And he said if I didn't identify myself, I would be arrested. Well, it wasn't the first time that I had been threatened with arrest. Two policemen took me under the arms. I went limp. They dragged me into the police car. And before I got into the police car, it was surrounded with people. It was 2 minutes at 12, there's this commotion going on, some people are joining in, some people are stopping to watch. This police car is going nowhere.
I just did what any of my fellow students, or my fellows in all these organizations, would have done. So I was just singled out, chance selected me, I'm no martyr.
I found I couldn't understand why people were prohibited from speaking in the plaza. And if this demonstration around this police car was some way to indicate it was wrong, well, it seemed like a good idea to me. I didn't like the idea of seizing a police car very much, but it was certainly a peaceful seizing. People began to speak.
The only reason that I took part in this is because I like Cal very much. I'd like to see it better.
And they'd stand on the car. People were very careful about the car. People would take their shoes off and gently climb up on the car. They moved from the hood of the car up onto the roof of the car. Then the argument raged. Are you with us or are you against us? I wasn't either. I was watching and listening to speeches.
There was an open microphone on top of the police car, and anybody who wanted to speak could sign up on a list, and they had 3 minutes to say anything they wanted to say. And hour after hour, people were getting up and orating. And it was like an explosion of ideas.
You know, Aristotle said, if you are not a citizen, you are either a beast or a god. Now I ask you a very simple question.
People start talking, bringing in the Greek philosophers, bringing in the French Revolution, talking about all these ideas, constitutional liberties, as if they had meaning.
Late at night, there was some fraternity people who came down, and there was some confrontation. They were talking and bringing it up, but I remember they were heckling from the back, so one of the people on the mic says, come on up. They got one of the fraternity boys to come up and to say his thing on the mic. And by the time he got there, he forgot why he was against it, and his friends started booing him.
It really was a political awakening, because there was a political issue here, and we were all part of this. We weren't observing it on television. We were actually part of deciding what would happen, as was the university administration. No one from the university administration came to speak. No one came to present any reasoned point of view about why the arrest had occurred or why the rules restricting political speech were justifiable. Nothing.
I ended up sitting in that police car for 32 hours, and at the maximum time, there were as many as 6,000 people sitting down around the police car. At various points when the police were arrests were threatened, people didn't run away. More people came and sat down, and people were trying to avoid it, felt they had to sit down. People were saying, join us, join us. Mario and a delegation is off negotiating with the administration, and right at the final minute, they arrive, and a settlement has been reached.
May I please have that decision?
What's the word now, Doctor?
Well, there's been an agreement signed.
An agreement signed?
Yes, by the student groups and by me as president of the university, which has several points to it. The first point is that the student demonstrators shall desist from their illegal actions protesting university regulations. We've also agreed to set up a committee to examine the rules.
The remarkable thing about this entire situation is that there's been a coalition that I think is completely unusual in politics. There's been a coalition from Youth for Goldwater all the way over from the Young Socialist Alliance. And usually these two groups don't even speak together, let alone sit in the same table and work out general policies and platforms. And I think that this, I'm proud to say that American students are united on one issue, and that's the First Amendment privileges of freedom of speech, to allow the right to advocate and discuss at any time, at any place, as long as it doesn't disturb classes and interfere with traffic.
Our meetings lasted 10, 12, 15, 18 hours. People slept at different times during some of them and came back because we had two goals, to figure out what to do and to try to keep this enormous coalition together, understanding the power of all of these groups moving in the same direction around this issue. And that takes a long time because you can't do it by a majority vote. The minority just says, oh, okay, I'm gone. It had to be by consensus. People had to agree, and it took forever. We called it boring, disgusting, time-consuming democracy.
I remember one administrator described the whole of the free speech movement to me as a civil rights panty raid. Now, in a way, that's not such a dumb description, because he did see, oh, these kids are having a good time, and it's all very exciting. It's just, instead of being about panties, it's about civil rights. But what he failed to see is that there was a real underlying seriousness to this. There was a tremendous sense of community. It's as if all these students had been waiting to get together and work together, and suddenly they did it.
6 weeks ago, they promised us that they would negotiate on their regulations of free speech. Yes, they have negotiated. They have blocked every attempt that we have made. If they refuse to come to a stand, we will also consider negotiations as being broken by them. However, we will continue to try and get them to come to a vote or take a stand or make a decision.
As Mario Savio would talk about a meeting and tell what happened in the meeting and explain the positions taken by the administration, and from what I could tell, would tell exactly what had gone on, I would then contrast that with the administration's explanation. Muffled, guarded. The administration would not explain what had happened. They wouldn't tell the truth. I think a lot of people became very upset about what administration spokesmen would say was going on when they knew it wasn't true.
What you have there are a few of these rather bearded, unwashed characters with sandals and long hair who normally would be regarded sort of tolerantly as a lunatic fringe, which you put up with, but you do not necessarily encourage. And in effect, the campus has been turned over to these characters.
Somewhere in the process of the FSM, for the very first time, the young, privileged, affluent children of the culture began to see themselves as an oppressed class. It was an astounding perception, you know, because here we were the height of the privilege, the best students at the best multiversity, destined to be the managers of the society, and in the middle of this, we turned around and looked at our education and said, wait a minute, somehow the best is the worst. It put us out of touch with the society. It severed technology from values. It severed the intellect from the heart. For many people, this was the only educational activity that we were involved in that was deeply meaningful.
Little baby, don't you cry. You know your mama was born to die.
Got a little book with pages three, and every page
was a point in late November when it became clear that the administration had finally figured out how to break us apart as a coalition. And that was, they said we could have our tables back. We could do all the things we wanted to do, but we couldn't advocate unlawful activity lest we'd still be liable for discipline as students on the campus. It was very clear to us that the only groups that last part of the rule were aimed at were those who used civil disobedience in their strategies for change. That meant the left and the civil rights movement. Well, we felt quite defeated.
This position on the question of advocacy, which the president has recommended, which the regents have now approved, is far severer than any which has been recommended by any faculty committee, and, of course, is totally unacceptable to the students and constitutes, in fact, prior restraint on speech, on political expression on campus.
So you've lost a lot of ground.
Well, it's very hard to say.
Fortunately, the university committed another atrocity.
They could not end this whole incident without punishing somebody and teaching a lesson that something like this should never again happen. And so when students got back after Thanksgiving break, they found out that the eight people who had originally been cited had received letters saying that disciplinary proceedings leading to expulsion had begun against them.
So here we are. Four students are getting the axe. Six organizations are getting the axe for standing up this semester and for fighting for these things. They're getting the axe not for what they did, but for what we have done. They spoke for us, they were part of us, they have been singled out, and they're going to be chopped off.
We were told the following: if President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Could you not go into Sproul Hall? Everybody was going into Sproul Hall. It was a what other alternative did you have to say that you weren't happy with the way things were going?
I hesitated for about 2 seconds, and I thought, you know, I got a picture of my husband's face, and I thought, what is this going to do? You know, what is it going to do to my career? What is it going to do to my life? And then I just said, to hell with it. I don't care what it does. This is my chance to do something, and I'm going to do it.
The fourth, third, and second floors are filled. Stay downstairs.
The Bay Area Civil Rights Movement in the stairwell over there.
People were dancing in the hallways. People were studying. people were just sitting on the cold floors, wandering around, talking with each other. It was chaos and confusion, and it was sort of like a party. And it went on and on and on. And finally, the police decided that if you wanted to go out, you could go out, but you couldn't get back in. I debated about this for some... I don't really think I was in the position of deciding to make witness or not make witness a great moral decision. It was getting to be dinner time. It was getting in or not getting in. I had no idea this was going to go on for a long time. When I came back, people were climbing with ropes up the front of Sproul Hall. It was clear that something was happening, but it wasn't really clear what.
May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor of the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement. This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired. Please go.
I wanted to run. My impulse was to run. I was sort of hanging on to the people next to me to keep myself from jumping up. And right at that time, something really neat happened, and that was Art Goldberg was the leader of our floor. He was in charge of us. And he was standing there. He heard they were coming up on the elevators, and so he was giving us a speech on what you do, how you go limp. And he was saying, now when the cops come at you, you don't want to fight them, you just want to go limp. And as he's saying this, the cops are coming at him. He talked all the way down to the floor. And I know this because I was looking between their legs. It was really an inspiration. And I said to myself, if he can do that, that's what I'm going to try to do. So when they got to me, they said, do you want to walk out like a lady or are you going to get dragged out? And I said, I want to get dragged out like a lady.
Husky dogs, pom-pom girls, you see all the way. Oh, what fun it is to have your mind reduced to clay. Civil rights, politics, just get in the way. Questioning authority when you should obey.
Pom-pom sleeping on the lawn in a double sleeping bag doesn't get things done. Freedom is a drag. Chuck your principles. Don't stand up and fight. You won't get democracy if you yell all night.
With the arrests came a massive collapse of the authority of the campus administration. Now, they made a desperate attempt to regain that authority in a big meeting at the Greek Theater.
The departmental chairman believe that the acts of civil disobedience on December 2nd and 3rd were unwarranted and that they obstruct rational and fair consideration of the grievances brought forward by the students. There are a small number of individuals, I regret to say, who are interested in fomenting a crisis merely for the sake of crisis. They hope that continuing chaos will bring about a total revolution and their own particular concept of utopia.
The university supports the powers of persuasion against the use of force.
The constructive act as against the destructive blow. Respect for the rights of others. Opposition to passion and hate. The reasoned argument as against the simplistic slogan. The academic world and the people of this state expect of us conduct commensurate with our past achievements and our high capacities. We should expect no less of ourselves. Thank you.
The police have got Mario away. The police have pulled Mario away from the speaker stand. They're pulling back.
He tried to exercise free speech. When he stood up there, the police took
lock them away. That shows the entire process that's going on campus.
We, of course, had no notion that Mr. Savio was going to try to speak at the end of this meeting. He asked, just a moment. He asked, just a moment.
Just let him speak, you're killing yourself more.
He asked, he asked me at the beginning of the meeting whether he would be allowed to speak at this meeting. I said that he would not because this was a structured meeting, not an open forum, and we had a program which had been approved.
They're a bunch of hypocrites and bastards.
Even if the Greek theater had gone exactly according to plan, it still would have been a flop. But it was worse than a flop. It was a fiasco, and there was a kind of pandemonium on the campus. And speaking political here, there was a power vacuum. Who the hell was in charge? Nobody knew. And a bunch of us drafted a resolution. We took that resolution into the Academic Senate, and it passed by over 7-1. The overwhelming majority of the faculty had come down firmly on the side of free speech. So when the faculty marched out into this cheering mob of students, we knew that was it. That was victory. We had achieved everything we had set out to achieve in the FSM.
Student rallies at the University of California at Berkeley over the past 2 months have become commonplace. But today's rally in front of Sproul Hall has taken on a different tone. Several thousand students have gathered for what has been billed as a victory celebration, a victory the students feel is assured as a result of yesterday's action by the Academic Senate.
We're asking that there be no restrictions on the content of speech save those provided by the courts. And that's an enormous amount of freedom. And people can say things within that area of freedom which are not responsible. And now we've finally gotten into a position where we have to consider being responsible because, you know, now we have the freedom within which to be responsible. And I'd like to say, at this time, I'm confident that the students and the faculty, University of California, will exercise their freedom with the same responsibility they've shown in winning their freedom.
People thought, this is it. I mean, this is day one of a new era. We're going to have a completely different kind of a university. We can sit down and replan the whole structure of the university. If we want, we can have the administrators just busy sweeping sidewalks. That was a popular slogan in those days. We can have a completely different conception of education. Worse yet, we attracted to Berkeley the worst collection of kooks and nuts you've ever seen in your life. Everybody saw this on television, and they had a completely distorted conception of it. They thought, what you do is you go to Berkeley, and you riot, and you just have a great time. It's one big political, sexual, drug feast. Didn't Ronald Reagan himself say that it was all drugs and sex and radical politics? So they had this absurd conception of what was going on. The media exaggerated in a certain sort of way. And we had created a set of expectations that were really not satisfiable.
The thing that irritated me the most and the stuff that came out about that period was the description of us as alienated and cynical. We were the absolute antithesis of that. We were so committed and so involved, we risked our careers, we risked our jobs, our education, and we did it because we were so tied into this system, to this country, to this culture. We believed in it so much that we were willing to take those risks at a time when it wasn't very popular to do so.
I'd never realized that there were those who would lie to maintain their positions of power. Then I saw it. I'm not sure. I don't think people were evil to lie, but they did it. They altered the way things were to maintain their positions of power and authority, and they did it in a way that was wrong. And when I saw that, then I saw that everywhere. I saw that in the structures of political power in Oakland. I saw that in the structures of political power in the South. And I began to see that the mechanisms that the free speech movement was attempting to change were mechanisms that operated everywhere.
I was at a rally where Mario was speaking. I remember that he was the speaker. And it was
It was some kind of a wrap-up rally, like maybe it was right after the trial or something like that. And it was sort of like, well, the FSM is over. We've got it all. That's all settled. And my feeling was, okay, that's settled. Now I can go on with my life. And I was even walking away from the rally before Mario was quite finished. And I remember I have this very clear memory of his voice, you know, ringing out as I'm leaving Sproul Plaza, and he's saying, now don't everybody go walking away, because we've still got a war to stop. And I just, you know, looked around real startled, and I thought, war? What war? And then it turned out that it was the Vietnam War.
And if I can have your help, if I can have your hand, if I can have your heart, if I can have your prayers, if the good Lord is willing, I will continue to try to lead this nation and this world to peace.
Oh, I march to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War.
Victory in our struggle for civil rights and free speech made us confident that we could change the course of history. Then we learned about Vietnam, and stopping the war became our consuming cause.
The first really large activity in opposition to the Vietnam War was Vietnam Day in May 1965. There was a parade of speakers, the one after another, started telling us something that we didn't really know, which was what our country was doing in Vietnam.
Most of us grew up thinking that the United States was a great and humble nation that only involved itself in the affairs of other countries reluctantly and as a last and final resort. But now the war in Vietnam has provided the incredibly sharp razor that has finally separated thousands and thousands of people from their illusions about the morality and integrity of this country's purposes internationally. Never again will the self-righteous, saccharine moralism of promising $1 billion of economic aid while we spend billions and billions of dollars to destroy them, never again will that moralism have the power to persuade people of the essential decency of this country's aims. What kind of a system is it that allows decent men, good men, to make the decisions that have led to the thousands and thousands of deaths that have happened in Vietnam? What kind of a system is it that justifies the United States in seizing the destinies of other people and using them callously for our own ends? We must name that system, and we must change it and control it, else it will destroy us.
The war started to escalate rapidly. Every month, another 20,000 soldiers shipped out to Vietnam. Many of them came through Berkeley. Some of us decided to stop the trains.
I was walking next to a woman, and she told me that she was a Buddhist and that she had been pulled into stopping the war by the immolations of the priests. And she said she was going to sit on the tracks, and so I said, okay, I will too. As the train came around the bend, I thought, now it's going to have to slow down. But it sped up. And then as it got closer to us, it began shooting out steam. As the steam hit me, I jumped out of the steam. Then I looked at the woman that I'd been talking to, and she was sitting in a full lotus position in the middle of the tracks. And as the train went rushing by, I thought she was under it. When the train got past, I looked at the tracks and I expected to see a big pile of blood, and there was nothing. She had just disappeared. Well, a few days after that, the same woman came walking into the Lowy Museum where I was working, leading a big group of children on a tour through the museum. And I said, what happened? What did you do and what happened? And she said, oh, well, the plainclothes policeman snatched me off the track just before the train got there. And I said, were you going to stay there? Were you going to sit right on the track and let the train kill you? And she said, well, yes, I was going to do that then, but that isn't what happened. So now I'm here taking these children through the museum. And it really struck me, it really hit my heart, that here was a person who was ready to give her life to try to stop the war. And I think that's when it really came through to me just how important it was.
What we have to do is let's get rid of this tactical point. Let's submit all...
In the fall of 65, the Vietnam Day Committee organized its first anti-war march. The destination was the Oakland Army Terminal. The city of Oakland refused a permit. The VDC voted to march anyway.
All in favor of the motion to march regardless of permit? All opposed?
The Vietnam Day Committee intends to have a peaceful march through Oakland this evening. We intend no civil disobedience. We do not intend to break any laws. We've made this point quite clear. We think it's incredible that the Oakland authorities have denied us a permit for this march.
Policy is going to be the following. We are going to march down Telegraph Avenue. We hear that a cordon is very likely to be formed right past the Oakland City line. This is a very dangerous situation that can create a great peace movement or destroy it. We urge your cooperation.
We had a problem. The Oakland police had put up a barricade at the Oakland line, and we had to deal with what we were going to do when the march got to that point. Some of us ran ahead to try to see if we could bluff our way through, and it was absolutely clear it was going to be a bloody situation. And I just decided that we're turning. I basically was the person who made that decision. Got, for years afterwards, got great degrees of shit for it. Never knew if I did right or wrong. I still don't know if it was right or wrong decision.
The next day, an even larger march made a second attempt to cross into Oakland. Once again, a police cordon was waiting. And this time the marchers faced another obstacle, Hell's Angels.
Quiet, you people, go home!
Each attempt to stop the anti-war movement seemed to make our numbers grow. A month later, a third march, far greater than the first two, finally made it into Oakland.
For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
The whole national mythology was that Vietnam was a consensus war, was bipartisan foreign policy. All significant sectors of the American public accepted the war, and the people who opposed it were marginalized freaks, kooks, you know, unimportant people. It was a real statement for a person to say, yes, I'm willing to march out against the war. And when thousands of people did that, it broke that consensus. That was a function, that's what the anti-Vietnam War movement did. It broke that consensus.
You got the march, oh Lord, you got the march when the spirits are marched.
Go ahead, just react.
Well, what do you want? React to what?
React to the greatness of the march of the day and of the victory or what? Are you happy with it?
Hari Om Namo Shiva. Hari Om Namo Shiva. Hari Om Namo Shiva. Hari Om Namo Shiva. Hari Om Namo Shiva.
Ronald Reagan walked onto the political stage as a candidate for governor in 1966. During his campaign, he found that attacking what he called the mess at Berkeley pleased the crowds.
It began a year ago when the so-called free speech advocates, who in truth have no appreciation for freedom, were allowed to assault and humiliate the symbol of law and order, a policeman on the campus. And that was the moment when the ringleaders should have been taken by the scruff of the neck and thrown out of the university once and for all.
He won by pandering to a citizenry that was outraged by what these terrible, insolent, ungrateful children were doing on the campuses.
As a matter of fact, I have here a copy of a report of the district attorney of Alameda County. It concerns a dance that was sponsored by the Vietnam Day Committee, sanctioned by the university as a student activity, and that was held in the men's gymnasium at the University of California. The incidents are so bad, so contrary to our standards of human behavior, that I couldn't possibly recite them to you here from this platform in detail. But there is clear evidence that there were things that shouldn't be permitted on a university campus. Let me just read a few excerpts. The total crowd at the dance was in excess of 3,000, including a number of less than college-age juveniles. Three rock and roll bands were in the center of the gymnasium, playing simultaneously all during the dance. And all during the dance, movies were shown on two screens at the opposite ends of the gymnasium. These movies were the only lights in the gym proper. They consisted of color sequences that gave the appearance of different colored liquids spreading across the screen, followed by shots of men and women on occasion. Shots where the men and women's nude torsos on occasion, and persons twisted and gyrated in provocative and sensual fashion.
Foreign tour within the continental limits and fountainhead of the hippie subculture. The hippies is often a strange world in which they live in. They take many trips. And the trip of the hippies is generally an unusual one.
Across the bay from Berkeley, a counterculture emerged on the streets of San Francisco. Descended from the hipsters of the beatnik era, hippies further exposed the chasm between our parents' generation and our own. By 1966, more and more of us were turning on, tuning in, and dropping out. Our alienation ran much deeper than political protest.
We were all beginning to see that it was much, much bigger than the war. It was much, much bigger than the civil rights movement. There were major things wrong. And I think the people who got involved in the counterculture on some level perceived that they did not want to be a part of what was wrong with a culture that was destroying the world. Now, I can see that much better in retrospect than I could right then. But the point is that it was the culture that was sick. It was the whole American way of looking at things that was sick. And so I think we came to a realization that one way to change that is to just live it differently. Instead of trying to change the structure in a direct confrontational way, you just drop out and live it the way you think it ought to be.
You play anything besides a sweet potato?
Yes, the drums. Cougar drums and trumpet. Yeah, and I go up in the mountains and yell now and then.
You do what?
Go up in the mountains and yell. Way up in the high in the mountains and yell as hard as I can.
What's the purpose of that?
Well, to greet the dawn, and to greet the noonday sun, and to greet the sunset.
You mean you stay up there all day, yelling at morning, noon, and night?
Right. And standing on my head, and making gardens, and painting pictures.
You mean you not only play the sweet potato, you also grow them?
Right.
Why do you indulge in smoking these narcotic cigarettes?
Why do people drink alcohol?
It's the same reason.
It's just a big ping pong table, you know? I mean, you say, why do we do this? And we say, why do you do this? You know, we don't agree.
Well,
you're the mess, you know, and we're trying to change it.
What are you trying to change it to, though? What are your principles, or do you have any?
We're not trying to change anything. We're just trying to be ourselves, man, to be what we want to be and do what we think is right.
Why don't you go out in the desert somewhere where it's clean and healthy instead of dirty up a community?
We're not dirtying up any community.
My parents sent away to the Bay Area a serious young folk singer. I came back with long hair down to there. I was wearing an enormous amount of beads around my neck. They figured I had abandoned everything I was taught. And I realized, you know, I mean, we had big arguments about this stuff, and I tried to convince them to sell all their furniture and go to India. And they weren't going for it. And I realized that no matter how far out their political views were, because they were mighty unpopular, my parents were pretty left-wing, that really they were materialists. They were concerned about how the wealth was divided up. And I was at that point in my consciousness where I didn't care about wealth. We were actually living communally rather than talking about communism.
Sell the radio, get rid of the subscription, tune in to those other bands that do not broadcast in words, that broadcast in joy. The form of God is the joy of his discovery.
Up, up, up. Everybody goes up, you see.
The counterculture burst onto the Berkeley campus during a strike in the fall of 66. At the close of a meeting, students started to sing Solidarity Forever, then suddenly switched to Yellow Submarine.
They're singing about we all live in the Yellow Submarine. What's this mean?
It's difficult to explain. And I think we take this music seriously. And there's a meaning which everyone can interpret it differently about the Yellow Submarine. It's an understanding that we're banding together in a yellow submarine, and that it represents a new way of looking at life.
The radicals of Berkeley and the hippies of Haight-Ashbury had a natural affinity. We were visionaries, critical of conventional society. But we disagreed about how to change the world. This running argument came to a head over the war in Vietnam. I've got a friend
somewhere. Sometime in late 1966, Bill Miller, who had been active in the Vietnam War movement, was running a bar in Berkeley, called a bunch of people that were active in the anti-war movement to a meeting behind his bar. There were some people from the Haight-Ashbury who were going to be organizing some kind of activity, and they wanted to tell us about it and ask for support. Well, it was going to be the first be-in. There was this one fellow in particular. He was trying to really get us excited about the plan. He said, "And we're going to have so much music and so much love and so much energy that we're going to stop the war in Vietnam."
The politics of HIP is that we were setting up a new world, as it were, that was going to run parallel to the old world, but have as little to do with it as possible. We just weren't going to deal with straight people. And to us, the politicos, a lot of the leaders of the anti-war movement, were straight people because they were still concerned with the government. They were going to go march on Washington. We didn't even want to know that Washington was there. I mean, we thought that eventually the whole world is just going to stop all this nonsense and start loving each other as soon as they all got turned on. It's amazing that these movements coexisted at the same time, were in stark contrast in certain respects, but as the 1960s progressed, drew closer together and began taking on aspects of the other.
Terrible jam.
Byrne stumbled out of that bunker dazed, with blood on him, parts of his friends on him. He collapsed into the arms of Larry Craig. And he mumbled to Larry Craig. He didn't mumble, "Those bastard Viet Cong." He didn't mumble, "Those bastard communists." He didn't mumble, "Those slope-eyed bastards." He mumbled only one thing over and over: "That bastard Johnson. That bastard Johnson."
The aim is to build a powerful peace bloc that can really have influence in the 1968 elections. And we must make it clear that we aren't going to let our political forces and the politicians ignore Vietnam in 1968. This must be an issue if that tragic war is still going on. And so as the war hawks escalate the war in Vietnam, we must escalate our protest against the war.
We're in front of the Oakland Induction Center today because this place is going to be closed down October 16th to 21st. We are declaring a draft holiday for that period, and we're going to close this building down.
The movement from protest to resistance, which was the official slogan of the Stop the Draft Week and became a major slogan within the anti-war movement, had something to do with the logic of the anti-war movement itself. There had been 6, 7, 8 years of educating people about the war and of sort of protesting it. And meanwhile, the war was being escalated all the time, getting worse and worse and worse. And there was a feeling of impotence in the face of the further escalation of the war.
We were becoming much more alienated from American society and much more willing to be disruptive of that society. And basically, we began moving toward the view that we wanted to make, to make the cost of pursuing the war abroad, the ungovernability of the society at home.
I've been very influenced by Martin Luther King and Gandhi. I believe very deeply in nonviolent civil disobedience. And here were these leaders on campus. Now I was a graduate student. And they were saying, we have to raise the stakes. We have to stop the war in a much more militant way. And I found their rhetoric seductive.
I think we were pretty convinced that we were going to shut down the induction center when we went down there. We felt strong. There were a lot of us. We felt well organized. We had a lot of planning meetings.
We didn't want to say we don't cooperate with the war. We wanted to say, we aren't going to allow you to wage the war. We're going to fight you. Tuesday morning, the police came in wielding their clubs. And they took us seriously, you know. We said we were going to fight them, so they fought us. And it was a disaster. We just melted. They wiped us out.
Now it was, here come the buses, and there is not a damn thing you can do about it. And I began seeing all these young faces in the windows going by me, and I just wanted to reach out and just grab them and stop them and say, listen, this is your life you're putting on the line here. But what came out was, don't go.
There were busload after busload after busload of young men that day. And they were going off to die. And I remember being sort of physically sickened and realizing that I couldn't affect even that part of the war. Here I was face to face with these young men, and yet, you know, not one of them turned back. I don't think we stopped one inductee from making that critical choice of stepping across the line and going to Vietnam. I don't think we made one bit of difference that day.
Does a demonstration bother you?
No, I think it's kind of funny.
All them bums running around doing nothing.
Tomorrow, we go down there twice as strong as we did today. We go down there with twice as many shields as we did today. And we go down there with everybody wearing one of these. If you can see the dents in there, I don't know whether you can see it from here, but that's what stands between me and a cracked skull from the Highway Patrol of the state of California. Where do you get the hats? Army and Navy surplus.
We didn't give up. We didn't say, it didn't work. We were able to build for another demonstration on Friday. And on Friday, we in fact had our riot, the riot that we had planned.
Against the police and pushed them back block after block. And I remember thinking, this is like a metaphor. If enough Americans believed the war were wrong, we could end it.
Controlled the downtown area of Oakland for most of the day. And the cops were outnumbered and confused and scared. And we shut down the induction center. We did just what we said we were going to do. We shut the mother down.
I went to the Stop the Draft Week protests. And what I saw there made me convinced that action in the streets of that sort was not going to lead to the kind of change necessary to stop the war. I saw a lot of people from Berkeley tear people's fences down. Fences that belonged to people that probably made $5,000 a year were ripped out to block people's cars. Bobby Avakian, son of a judge, a well-known young would-be radical, let the air out of the tires of the federal district attorney. This was going to stop the war. I just thought this was a burlesque of opposition to the war.
It's come to this. There's nothing else to do. The picketing and all of that wasn't working. It's time for confrontation.
We did stumble upon a strategy where we said, hey, look it, if you continue that war in Vietnam, there's going to be chaos here in the streets of the United States. We could say, hey, every place you try to do anything that happens to do with the war, there's going to be thousands and thousands of young people rioting, trying to stop you from doing it.
While it was a great success and a turning point, it was also the first clear demonstration that the radical part of the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War movement was coming up against its own limitations. It didn't really have the weight in society to stop the war. And I think that it was after that that the Berkeley radical scene became more and more cut off from reality. And the question of moving American society, changing people, really was getting lost.
We began to sort of see ourselves as, glue in the keyholes. We began to see ourselves as obstacles in the way of of the system fulfilling its potential for, you know, wrecking destruction all over the world. I think we began to see ourselves as, well, you know, being as big a pain in the butt as we could. And I think we sort of lost the idea that we could be victorious.
As confrontation and sit-in and street demonstrations escalated, the rest of the United States political community was left behind. I was interested in the rest of the United States, in the Newport Beach. Those people I'd failed with in Thanksgiving vacation free speech movement were the people that you had to reach if you were going to stop the war. And the way to do that was not to go down and sit in the streets in front of the Oakland Draft Induction Center and tear up fences and block the streets. The way to do that was to be active electorally.
After the Tet Offensive, when Westmoreland came to Johnson and said, in order to continue the land war in Vietnam, we're going to need 1 million men. Johnson was told by J. Edgar Hoover that if we tried to get 1 million men out of this country, he could not ensure the domestic security of this country. And that was one of the questions, one of the considerations that he made when he decided to end the land war, to begin to pull back from the land war, when he decided to end the land war and to resign as an expression of the failure of his policy to win the war in Vietnam. And Hoover saying that he couldn't ensure domestic security was a truthful statement about the power of the anti-war movement at that time. We did put limits on America's ability to wage the war in Vietnam.
I shall not see, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
We want to talk about this thing called violence that everybody is so afraid about. Here you are talking about you afraid of violence and the honky drafting you out of school to go fight in Vietnam. You're going to sit in front of your television set and listen to LBJ tell you that violence never accomplishes anything, my fellow Americans. You ought to tell them clear. If you don't want any trouble, keep your filthy white hands off our beautiful flag.
The revolution has come.
Off the field.
It's time to pick up the gun.
Off the field.
Revolution has come.
Off the field.
It's time to pick up the gun.
Off the field.
Revolution has come.
In the streets of Oakland, a few miles from the Berkeley campus, the Black Panthers came forward as the cutting edge of black power. Their militancy had a magnetic effect on the student movement.
We want the Panthers to be our friends. We want to follow their lead in some fashion that's confusing, that's mysterious. All we are aware of, we want to go black and white together into some positive future against the oppressor who is feeling ever more oppressive.
Bobby Seale and Huey Newton formed the Black Panther Party in the fall of 66. They drew up a 10-point platform addressing community needs from education to housing. The most pressing issue was police violence against Oakland's black community. The Panthers decided to arm themselves and patrol the police.
When we patrol the police, people might imagine we were right behind a police car. No, we might be 4 or 5 blocks away. We just drive through the community, and if we see the police arresting somebody, we were going to get out of the car with our shotguns, tape recorders, law books. By this time, we got about 6 or 7 members doing this. All of us got guns. How we got our guns was fantastic, though, too, the first guns. The little red book, Chairman Mao Zedong, the thoughts of Chairman Mao Zedong. Huey calls me up one day and says, Bobby, I know how we can raise some money to get some more shotguns. I says, how, man? He says, the little red book. He says, all over the news. He says, I heard you can buy them at the China bookstore in Frisco. I says, wow, good. How much money you got him? I said, I don't know. I got 40, 50 bucks. Boom. So we run over to the China bookstore. We buy up about 100 of these books. Got our guns strapped on our side. I got a 45. He was holding a shotgun. Little Bobby got a carbine, but we got these little bags hanging over our shoulder with little red books. Get your red books, $1. We will buy them for 20 cents and sell them for $1. Berkeley campus at Xavier's Gate right there. We sold out in a matter of an hour. We took this $100. We go, we buy some more red books. We did, and we made about $200-$300. We went around and bought 2 shotguns that day with the little red book. We hadn't even read the thing. I mean, most people think that we came up with this hardcore ideology related to Mao Zedong. We must have sold a darn book 2 or 3 months before we decided to open the thing and actually read the little red book. Anyway, the next thing I know, I'm marching on the Capitol. Because we're up there to protest a bill they're trying to put in to keep us from carrying guns. Ronald Reagan is over here on the big front lawn. I got a statement to read.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless. At the very same time, racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people.
Ronald Reagan is escorted off the lawn by the state capitol police. I says, we can go inside somewhere. Isn't there a spectator section?
I have these Black Panthers up here, but the guns on the second floor. You get it.
Wait a minute. Am I under arrest?
Go ahead,
brother. Take your hands off me if I'm not under arrest. I'm telling you to take your hands off me.
They put trumped up charges of conspiracy and felonies on everyone who went in to exercise a constitutional right and said they had no right to bear arms in a public place. The California Penal Code section 12020 through 12027 and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
Our organization is like a social evolutionary accident, so to speak. I mean, when you compare the NAACP from 1908 and other organizations, et cetera, and all the years they put in to become established, in a matter of 6 months, the Black Panther Party has international notoriety. I mean, we're on the front pages of the London Times and papers in Africa somewhere. We're a broke little organization with a number of shotguns, a very weak treasury, and don't know one word about how to pay the rent. And boom, I mean, we're shocking people. We have probably said to white America, like the people who were observing us when we came up with the guns, are saying, niggas with guns. It's like a fear. I mean, they don't even have to say it. Their faces said it. There's too many niggas with guns. Like, they know that they've oppressed us. And now here we've organized with guns. It's the new step. I mean, it's symbolic that, oh, they're not going to be nonviolent anymore.
On the night of October 28, 1967, Huey Newton was stopped by police. There was gunfire. Officer Fry was killed, and Huey Newton was arrested for murder. His trial drew the student movement into an alliance with the Black Panthers. Free Huey became our rallying cry.
The organization just propelled. It took off like a prairie fire. It spread it everywhere, certainly beyond my imagination. I mean, after Huey's arrest, that's when things really started rolling.
The Panthers exercised heavy influence in the imagination of the white left, partly because the white left was confused about who it was and what it ought to do. They were fascinated by this tough macho image, and they followed it, not so much willfully, but involuntarily, because it was the projection out there of the thing in their own actions that thrilled them most.
We had captured the imagination of the white radical left in this country to a point that its whole identification became connected with what the Black Panther Party was doing, how it was personifying things. And it was like we influenced them in whatever direction we thought that they should go.
I don't like the word suck up, but I would say they were awed by the Panthers. There was something, the Panthers were somehow confronting the white power structure the way they would have liked to have done, some of them. Now, not all. Many of the whites who led the Stop the Draft Week that I had been involved with, many of those people who had been in some parts of early SDS was as skeptical as I was. But no one would, of course, say any of these remarks publicly. I mean, yeah, you didn't need that hassle. So what a lot of us did, I think to the detriment of the black movement, perhaps, and to the left movement in general, was that a lot of us with many years of political experience and political organizational skills dropped out. If not dropped out, stepped to the side during this period.
Huey
Robert P. Newton is the only leader that black people should recognize. A man who is willing to stand up and face that pig on his own terms. Gun for gun if necessary. This must be done. You cannot sit there and allow that man to be railroaded anymore. You must free our leader. He must be freed, and he will be free.
2 days after the assassination of Martin Luther King, the war of nerves between the Black Panthers and the Oakland police came to a climax. On April 6, 1968, a shootout erupted in which Eldridge Cleaver was wounded and Bobby Hutton was killed.
Bobby Hutton was instructed by the cops to run from here to the police car or the area where it was, and was literally shot down. He was shot over 10 times. He had 5 pistol bullets in his head. A clear-cut case of murder. As Brother Huey P. Newton says, the racist pig cops must stop their wanton murder and brutality or suffer the wrath of the armed black people in their black communities defending themselves.
Historically, in retrospect, those guns were somewhat our nemesis. We were never really able to play that down. The police, the media used that. We got hung up into a confrontational thing with the police over those guns that we were never really able to live down.
We say, bring it on. If you want war, let there be war. This is what we're saying. Is that clear?
In other words, if he is convicted and sentenced to death, Oakland will erupt.
This whole country is going to erupt, is what we're telling you. We're going to do everything that we can to see to it that the whole world erupts. Is that clear?
The Panthers seemed even crazier than they were because they were playing the media, and the media was loving them. The media picked up their current, fed the narrowest parts of their image back to us in the most dramatic hype terms that the Panthers themselves wanted them to be projected. It drove the police crazy. The police were furious, wanted to get them all over the country. And it drove some of us, it incited some of us with superficial fantasies of a kind of revolution that was completely inappropriate, had nothing to do with the actual landscape possibility. It was interesting to me more deeply and metaphorically, if that was what they were doing, what was appropriate in our community?
The Panthers, in a sense, let, in my opinion, white radicals off the hook, some white radicals, not all, but some white radicals off the hook from what SNCC had challenged them about 3 years earlier. That was to go organize the white community. They could say that they were supporting the Panthers because the Panthers were the vanguard. They had assumed that the movement could only be led by blacks. They had made that clear that the blacks would have to be the group that would start the revolution, and that the Panthers were the army of that black vanguard.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
I was taken up with now we're not only a protest movement, we're not only a movement to end the war in Vietnam, but we are a revolutionary movement. We were wrong. It wasn't a revolutionary situation, but, it was a mistake. everybody can make a few mistakes. At the time, it had a lot of the aspects to us of a revolutionary situation.
668 was a real high time. You know, what we were doing, you know, we identify with the student movement and the large protest movement in Paris. There was the Prague Spring and the feeling that revolution was in the air, east and west, capitalists and communists. It was all coming apart, and a new spirit, a new wave of liberation was in the air.
I felt that the world was unraveling, that history had speeded up. I could that the world was swirling around me. The movement had expanded. The anti-war movement was immense. The women's liberation movement had begun. The world simply was undergoing change at a rate that I could hardly comprehend. And yet I was in it, and I was part of it, and I was changing it. I always remember this particular period of time because the change was so phenomenal. I went to sleep one night and I was a woman who was dissatisfied with my position as a woman in society, but I felt solitary in that dissatisfaction. And suddenly I wake up and right and left, everybody is speaking about it. I have women who agree with me everywhere. We start to form a sisterhood. Everything in my life that has disturbed me is being challenged. Things that haven't disturbed me before, suddenly I look at and they do disturb me.
When we began to try to take a more active role in steering committees and, you know, decision-making forums in the movement, we began to see our comrades resisting our input. And we looked at them and we said, what? You know, how can they do this to us? You know, these are our brothers. Why aren't they interested in what we have to say? They're only interested in, you know, the fact that we're always there for them. And we always make the coffee and we run off the leaflets and we make all the telephone calls late into the night. And yet when we try to participate in a more active level, we meet resistance.
What you see here is the beginning of a movement that women are human beings and that we have equal rights. We intend to go to school. We intend to have child care so that we can go to school. We want the university to provide us with classes that teaches us about our history, the same as black people want to learn about their history. And that's what you see happening here today. This is just the beginning of it.
One of the ways the women's movement is the logical and maybe even inevitable conclusion of the 60s is that throughout the 60s we were trying to imagine how to live differently, how to change the world. And the women's movement took much from the civil rights movement, from the New Left, from the anti-war movement, but we brought it home. We brought it into the kitchen. We brought it into the bedroom. We brought it into the most personal and intimate aspects of people's lives. It was hard to deny there. It was hard to ignore those issues.
When I thought of revolution then, the whole idea had assumed complex, enormous dimensions. It didn't mean a simple change in the institutional order. It meant a coordinated change in all the dimensions, all the aspects of life, how we were with ourselves, how we were with each other. This was so complex a program, you couldn't write it down as the 13-point program of the Berkeley Revolutionary Front. You know, this was something that would take thousands, millions of people engaged all their lives in exploring this end of it and this end of it and how these ends might fit together. And it was clear by then that all this exploration was there to do. People had begun each part of the exploration. Okay, I forbear to list them, okay? And at the same time, it seemed impossible. There was no time. The war got worse faster. The political activity got worse faster. They were killing more and more people. Every time you placed some degree of hope in a national leader, ka-choo, ka-choo, you know? So much life, so much death, so much possibility, so much impossibility.
There we were, attempting to change national politics and found ourselves at the Chicago Convention. It changed American politics in unpredictable ways. We had not anticipated. We now, speaking as those involved in the electoral side of politics, did not anticipate the arbitrary exercise of authority that Mayor Daley would bring to bear in Chicago. And it was phenomenal.
Mr. Chairman, most delegates to this convention do not know that thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago. And for that reason, and that reason alone, I request the suspension of the rules for the purpose of adjournment for 2 weeks to relocate the convention in another city of the choosing of the Democratic National Committee and the presidential candidates.
Wisconsin is not recognized for that purpose.
There was a side of American politics that was vicious and violent, and that's what we saw in Chicago. Daley rolled over the anti-war forces, and it was a destruction of the Democratic Party. It seemed impossible that there could be any significant electoral path toward ending the war following the convention. It seemed that what had happened in the parks of Chicago made the anti-war movement destined for direct action for quite a period of time.
The violence in Chicago triggered confrontations on campuses across the country. Berkeley students calling for a third world college initiated a strike, which provoked daily battles between police and protesters. After 8 weeks, Governor Reagan sent in the National Guard, and the strike died down. Eventually, an ethnic studies program was established, but in the wake of the strike, an atmosphere of tension remained. A month later, student and community activists came together to create People's Park.
I was one of those people who believed that the counterculture could be revolutionary. And it's hard to talk about that without talking about People's Park. A group of people took some corporate land owned by the University of California that was a parking lot, turned it into a park, and then said, we're using the land better than you used it, and it's ours.
For a brief moment in history, in People's Park, the counterculture and political activists had a magical fusion. It was a way of looking at the future. It was utopian. It was a way of saying, if we had control of our lives, this is what it would look like.
Down-to-earth way, we were showing in our very activity the image of a new society. Our job is to form a counterculture, a more rural culture, a more decentralized culture, to develop counter values of cooperation, of production for use rather than production for profit, develop that culture in hope that that culture would be in revolutionary contradiction to bourgeois culture, and that we should view ourselves as revolutionaries, but really as founding mothers and fathers of this counterculture. I can almost convince myself of it now.
As I see it, the great hope implicit in the People's Park is that in our leisure time, so to speak, we will make the social revolution. Property is not a thing to keep men apart and at war, but rather a medium by which men can come together to play. A People's Park.
People's Park managed to focus all of the frustrations as well as some of the ideals of the 60s. There was a belief in the environment. There was a belief in the participation of ordinary people in political decision making. There was a belief that a whole lot of things ought to count that really traditionally don't count when they're caught up in government and university bureaucracies. There was all of that. But the fact remains that at bottom, I believe the People's Park incident was extremely cynical on the part of the demonstrators. They wanted a confrontation. What mattered was getting people out in the streets demonstrating.
Roger Hines and the Regents and Ronald Reagan can't allow this to go on. If there's one liberated territory, people may get the idea that there can be other liberated territories.
The park issue is not the issue. The issue is we must have a confrontation throughout the summer. There are out of confrontation issues, and as soon as you give them a park, they'll dream up another confrontation. We have been invaded by people outside of the state, outside of the cities. We have been invaded by militants. This is where we're in a revolution. And the only thing, don't ever say we're going into a revolution. We're in a revolution. Now the question is, who's going to win it?
When Jesus disrupted the foreign recruiters, all of his followers said,
power to the people, our demons out.
I declare this place decontaminated from poisons, chains, and lies, from the abomination that defiles. The demons have returned to the nothingness from which they came. Earth, water, air, and fire witness our liberation.
I want to inform you that this property is private. It is posted. You are now trespassing. And unless you leave, you will be arrested for trespassing.
If they didn't want the park, they should have stopped it a month ago when we started it. And not let us work on it every day and then just take it away. It's their part now. What can we do?
I have a suggestion. Let's go down to the People's Park.
We want the park! 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 We want the park!
People told you for days in advance that if the university sought to go ahead with that construction on that property, that they were going to physically destroy the university.
Now, why did you negotiate many times?
Negotiate? What is to negotiate? What is? Don't you wait a minute on that issue? Don't you simply explain to these students that the university has a piece of property that it bought for future construction of the campus, and it was now going ahead with the plan?
The people of
what do you mean, negotiate?
Governor Reagan, the time has passed when the university can just ride roughshod over the
the desires of the majority of its student body.
What
the university
just...
is a public institution.
That's
it's
right.
An important institution
but the university,
for all of its own community, and for the community of Berkeley that live around it.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
When the fence went up, the whole experience of People's Park changed. Governor Reagan brought in the National Guard. The city was occupied for a month. And what happened is the worst aspects of the movement emerged. People did things that were totally counterproductive. They tried to provoke the National Guard into fixing their bayonets. They tried to cause skirmishes on the campus. I found it possible to resist the feeling, the collective hallucination, that we were involved in a revolutionary struggle. But there was one moment when I simply became immersed in that feeling. There was a peaceful demonstration on Sproul Plaza denouncing the university's overreaction to the park, the police brutality towards students, the National Guard on the campus occupying the city.
My boyfriend and I and a friend of mine went down to the plaza to hear the rally. And as we got there, we realized that the police were letting people into the plaza, but they were not letting people out. My friend, by that time, had already gone through the police lines, and I motioned for her to come back, and they wouldn't let her out.
I started hearing the sounds of a helicopter, and it came closer and closer, and the sound got louder and louder, and suddenly the helicopter swooped over the whole campus, over all the students, and I thought, we're going to be shot at with the Viet Cong.
Everybody on the outside of the police line was running to try to get away from the gas. Everybody on the inside of the police line was trying to get out. And the police were beating people as they tried to get out. We went back to Kroeber Hall, and we waited for my friend to show up. And she had been through the mill. She had been throwing up. It was nausea gas. So we drove up to the Rose Garden. We were standing up there at the Rose Garden, looking out across the roses and out across the campus, and the helicopters... There were still helicopters circling around. And she looked at me and she said, I can't stand this. I'm going to get out of this. And I said, I think you're right. I think it's all over. I don't think that we can stay here anymore. And it was a very poignant moment. And a year later, we were all gone.
We all felt very defeated. It was a horrible experience to gas students at a peaceful rally. And it was one reason why people began to feel that we had to reassert what we really stood for, that we really had to protest the park in a dignified and peaceful way and recapture the original spirit of the park. And that led to the Memorial Day March.
Right on in.
We'll get People's Park back eventually. There's no doubt about that. Everybody who's ever done any hitchhiking in their life knows that basically we can't lose. When you sit out there and hitchhike, you see in the front seat, they're the parents. And they kind of give you this real scared, contemptuous look as they drive by you. But then in the back seat, as they're going away, you see all the kids and they're going... And we got the kids on our side and we can't lose. We just can't lose.
When you're in a mass movement to change society, when you're in this experience of sort of this democracy breaking out, you don't want it to end. You want the storm to continue. You want to keep that sense of change and overwhelming power that one gets from the ocean. And you might not be able to keep the rowboat straight or up, but you don't want the storm to die.
There was no vision, no articulate philosophy, no conception of social organization and social change. What there were a series of emotional moments, a series of passions, a series of desperately important issues. But you can't beat something with nothing. And if you're going to fight this kind of long cultural battle, you really are bound to lose if you don't have a coherent, articulate, well-worked-out vision of what you're trying to do, and that they didn't have.
We had taken what we had as far as we could go. I think that it's important not to lose sight of what that movement accomplished. That is, it was part of the struggle for civil rights. It was part of the movement in this country that broke down the Jim Crow barriers and changed the caste relationships of blacks and their minorities in our society. It was part of the movement that liberalized American culture. It was part of the movement that gave way to the ideas of women's equality and women's liberation. It was part of a movement that ultimately made it impossible to carry out so blatantly the kind of imperialistic foreign policy that characterized the period after World War II. American society was profoundly changed by the movements of the 60s.
In the 60s, we came at a certain point in the Cold War to reject the ideologies of both sides. And our declaration of freedom was a political freedom, but it had a larger dimension. That is the freedom of imagination. Having gained the freedom to see the world freshly and the ability to act for change, we carried what we learned into the rest of our lives. From personal issues to planetary concerns, we continue to explore the potential for change. And as we watch activists for human rights and democracy around the world challenge the powers that be, we know that each generation has its chance to make things change, and that no generation can do it alone.
you think it's crazy, this old world and its ways? Whoever thought the 60s would be called the good old days? But like the weaver sang to you, wasn't that a time when you raised your hands and voices on the line? And we all sang Bread and Roses, Joe Hill and Union Maid. We linked our arms and told each other we are not afraid. Solidarity forever would go rolling through the hall. We shall overcome together, one and all. The more I study history, I seem to find that in every generation there were times just like that time when folks like you and me who thought that we were all alone within that honored movement found a home. And they all sang Bread and Roses, Joe Hill and Union Maid. They linked their arms and told each other, we are not afraid. Solidarity forever would go rolling through the hall. We shall overcome together, one and all. And though each generation fears that it may be the last, our presence here is witness to the power of the past. And just as we have drawn our strength from those who now are gone, younger hands will take our work and carry on. And they'll all sing Bread and Roses, Joe Hill and Union Maid. They'll link their arms and tell each other, we are not afraid. Solidarity forever will go rolling through the hall. We shall overcome together, one and all. We shall overcome together, one and all.
We shall overcome someday.
We shall sit right here.
That's right. We shall sit right here. We shall sit right here. We shall not be able to be able to any other water. We shall not be able to.
and tell each other we are not afraid. Solidarity forever will go rolling through the hall. We shall overcome together, one and all. We shall overcome together, one and all.